Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to check in with University of Utah Law Professor Amos Giora. He is a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen and splits time between homes in Utah and Israel. We're going to talk about all the latest from Israel and Gaza, as well as the ongoing protests on college campuses in the United States. Amos Giora worked for 19 years in the Israel Defense Forces as a lieutenant colonel, held several senior command positions, including legal advisor to the Gaza Strip and commander of the IDF School of Military Law. And he's author of several books, including The Crime of Complicity and Armies of Enablers. Amos Giora, following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to check in with University of Utah Law Professor Amos Giora. He's a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen and splits time between homes in Utah and Israel. We'll talk about all the latest from Israel and Gaza, as well as the ongoing protests on college campuses in the United States. Amos Giora served for 19 years in the Israel Defense Forces as lieutenant colonel, held several senior command positions, including legal advisor to the Gaza Strip and commander of the IDF School of Military Law. He's author of several books, including The Crime of Complicity and Armies of Enablers. Professor Giora, thanks for joining us again.
It's always a pleasure to be with you.
So are you in Utah or Israel at this point?
I am sitting outside my doctor's office in Salt Lake City.
Okay, you're in Salt Lake City. I think quite recently yes, you've been in Jerusalem.
I came back Tuesday.
Yeah. So we talked, I looked it up, October 10th, just 3 days after the October 7th attacks by Hamas into Israel. Now several months have passed. Israeli forces, of course, have been moving through Gaza. I want to start with the attacks from Iran, the Iranian attacks. So were you in Israel at that point?
I was sitting in a plane in Newark trying to get home. My flight was canceled after we had already boarded, and I arrived the day after the attacks.
What is your friends and family telling you about those attacks, how those played out?
I think it depends who you ask. Most of my family members are cooler than a cucumber, and some of them probably slept through it, I think is the truth be told. Maybe others were a little bit more concerned, but I think there was such a sense that the attack will occur, notice had been given, the drones were being tracked, and I also need to give a huge shout-out to the Israeli Air Force, call it the anti-drone or anti-missile units that did an extraordinary job. At the end of the day, the damage was beyond minimal. And I think that is a true reflection of extraordinary capability in direct contrast, and I say this with a heavy heart, to much of what we saw pre-October 7th and after October 7th with respect to the IDF in Gaza. I think we probably want to discuss that. The response to the Iranian drones is textbook. Again, those who worked on this and acted on this and did their bit, huge shout out. On the other hand, whenever this will all end, there will indeed be reckoning with respect to the utter extraordinary intelligence failure and also, frankly, the lack of ability to, quote-unquote, defeat, no idea what that word means, Hamas. So these are two very different paradigms. I think that's important to note.
I want to treat that. So this intelligence failure, is that kind of on the back burner at this point, or is it still simmering? Anger against Netanyahu administration and others, or is that died down?
Last week, the head of the military intelligence resigned, and it's only a matter of time before the chief of staff resigns, before the head of our FBI resigns. There will be other generals who will resign. That's fine, and they need to resign. They need to take their bags with them and go home. The problem is that the government, the ministers in the government, beginning obviously with the prime minister, absolutely and totally, with perhaps one exception, refuse under any condition to accept any accountability or to recognize their accountability for the utter failure. And you have a profound disconnect between the intelligence community and the military accepting responsibility as compared to the government, which is a classic textbook example of avoiding, evading, assuming any sense of accountability and responsibility. It's one of the reasons that there is, fluctuates as these things do, tension between the military and the government, because I think the military understands that the government is only too happy to, quote unquote, throw them under the bus. And one of the complexities, or one of the results of this, is the hostage negotiations, the ceasefire, and the entering Rafah, the southern city in Gaza. These are three issues that the government, Netanyahu, because he's the quarterback here, who is utterly incapable of making any decision, and as a result of which we are, in polite English, we are utterly and totally stagnant with no clear sense of resolution whatsoever.
I want to read something you wrote in October. This is an op-ed piece in Salt Lake Tribune, fairly soon after the October 7th attacks from Hamas. So this is Amos Gior writing, "While prognostication is always fool's gold, the working assumption is that a ground incursion will begin in the days ahead, that the international community's support of Israel will diminish when the human cost to Gazans becomes the predominant story, and then negotiations, without using that word, will begin." I think that has definitely, except for the negotiation, well, I guess maybe negotiation behind the scene, but certainly the ground incursion from Israel into Gaza, certainly I think public support for Israel, I guess at a high point on October 7th, has, you could say, diminished as the toll on Gaza has increased.
We're still getting an A for being a predictor, huh?
Yeah, that's pretty good.
There are clearly negotiations with respect to the hostages. It's very clear that, and not only with respect to the hostages, but there's also enormous pressure on Netanyahu from President Biden and Secretary of State of Blinken not to go forward with this Rafah incursion. This is one of the sources of tension between the military and Netanyahu. Netanyahu keeps saying there's a date for it, and anybody who knows Netanyahu knows that he's incapable of speaking anything. Sorry, I'll rephrase. Netanyahu is incapable of speaking the truth. So when he says there's a date, everybody knows that's just not true. With respect to the hostages, I mean, I looked at it literally an hour ago, because there is ongoing negotiations. There was hope yesterday there would be some kind of resolution, and according to Hamas, according to what is being reported about Hamas, I think the correct expression would be that they have thrown cold water on it. But these things, there's a public posturing that is actually what happened. But there is indeed negotiation. There have been hostages released. On the other hand, there are hostages who have been held there since October 7th. I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say that in many quarters, whether it's particularly in the Western world, Israel is close, and I'll use these words carefully, to being ostracized, perhaps in some quarters a pariah state. Maybe that's a tad of an exaggeration, but there have been comparisons between Israel today and South Africa when there was apartheid, in terms of how the international community viewed then South Africa, today Israel. And I think that's a reality that, again, the Israeli government, euphemism Netanyahu, is so disdainful of the world that he really genuinely couldn't care less about that, with one exception. And that is, if the International Criminal Court goes forward with the issuing of arrest warrants for him and others, the rumor, the rumor is that these arrest warrants will be issued, I think, by tomorrow. That's the word in the street. What the problem from his perspective, and this is the way he thinks, it simply means that he can't leave Israel. And for somebody who sees himself as the person of the world to be, quote-unquote, landlocked and not able to leave Israel, is probably the only thing that really, quote-unquote, moves him. His disdain for President Biden, for the Congress, except for the Republicans who he sees as a support base, the evangelicals here in the United States. Western Europe is turning its back, has turned its back on Israel. I'm not sure about the Far East, but I think that the support in the aftermath, in the mid-aftermath of October 7th, the high point, where are we today, May 2nd, May 3rd, I think we're at a low point, which will only get lower.
Do you think the offensive in Rafah will go forward?
First of all, I begin by saying I certainly hope not. And I think the fact that Netanyahu can't decide is a reflection, again, of his inability to make decisions whatsoever. As I say, President Biden and Secretary of State Blinken have made American opposition to this as clear as it can be. I think it's also clear if there is an incursion into Rafah, that will be the death knell for the hostages. I participated in the weekly Tel Aviv rally on Saturday night. To call it sad would be optimistic. It was doom and gloom, because as many of the posters say, pointing a finger at Netanyahu, it says, you are responsible, you are guilty. And the next line then is, by not releasing the hostages, you are, translating to English, you are signing their death sentence in many ways. And I think an incursion into Rafah will result in that. I also don't know how the Egyptians will react to an IDF incursion into Rafah. And it's clear that, you know, the IDF, as far as one can tell, is ready. But here's a significant issue, because I told you there are two different IDFs. There's the Air Force, which did an extraordinary job. And then in Gaza, if you really think about this strategically, the IDF began in northern Gaza, went down, and the next step is, if it goes forward, is eminently predictable. Everybody knows that the IDF is considering going into Rafah, or the government is considering sending the IDF into Rafah, which is, again, in the context of predictability, is so predictable, which obviously increases, from my perspective, absolutely unnecessarily, the risk and danger to Israeli soldiers. And for me, that's unconscionable.
So, possibility, I guess, of International Criminal Court, handing out indictments, or I guess whatever the term is. Do you think that would prevent or discourage Netanyahu from further action?
I think that if the threat of an ICC issuance of an arrest warrant serves to prevent the IDF from going into Rafah, then sign me up for this warrant. Because, it's poker. We're playing high-level poker here. If that's what will force Netanyahu to recognize that there are indeed international limits, that the international community is clearly imposing limits on him and other decision-makers by issuing an arrest warrant for them, meaning that anytime they leave Israel or go to Europe, they will be arrestable. If that's what leads to the IDF not going into Rafah, they say, sign me up.
So, what do you think the end goal is, from the government's perspective? Destruction of Hamas? Is this going to end up with an occupation of Gaza?
Netanyahu has one interest and one interest in mind only, and that's his own political survival. Because he understands that the moment the hostages are released, the government will fall. The government will fall because there are two extreme right-wing members of the government. One is the Minister of, translating into English, State Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir, and the other is the Minister of Finance, Smotrich, who have made it very clear that if the government engages in the hostage release negotiations, if the government authorizes the hostage release, they will leave the government, and then the government will fall, and that will be the end of Bibi Netanyahu. He has a vested interest in his own political survival. I remind you that he's under trial as we speak. There's an ongoing trial in the District Court of Jerusalem. The only thing that motivates Bibi Netanyahu is one thing and one thing only, and that is Bibi Netanyahu. His concern for the hostages, his concern for the state, his concern for anything beyond his own survival is zero, and that is probably an exaggeration to say it's even as much as zero. This is to his lasting, never-ending shame.
You mentioned weekly protests. Those have been ongoing for quite a while. What is, you mentioned the mood there, kind of somber this last time. What are the people wanting with those protests?
So it's, you ask a very interesting question. After October 7th, there was recognition that this was not the time to protest. First of all, because there were, I think the numbers, there were 300,000 Israelis called up to reserve duty. I mean, a lot of the reservists are not one-to-one, but many reservists had also been participating in the demonstrations. And Israel was under attack, and Israel was at war. So there was a lull in the demonstrations. I think probably about a month or a month and a half ago, the demonstrations began again. It's important to state there are people who had protested against the government's judicial reform efforts and were until recently hesitant to go protest while soldiers are at risk in Gaza. Also, in the aftermath of the Iranian attack, to your question, there may be some people who are hesitant to leave the safety of their homes. So the demonstration on Saturday, there were fewer people than in previous demonstrations, and the mood is somber. What is it that we want? I think two things. One is the immediate release of the hostages, and two are elections now. And so people walk around with shirts, with stickers. I even have a sticker on my sweatshirt that says elections now. And that is one of the two or three most important goals at the moment. The other, obviously, is the release of the hostages. I can't emphasize that sufficiently enough. So the demonstrations are, I don't know if Tom, if you've ever been to Tel Aviv, but the demonstrations take place in two different areas. One is the main street in Tel Aviv where the demonstrations against the government are held. And then when that ends, we walk, literally physically walk, to a different area, which is where the, we would call it in English, hostage square, the square of the hostage families, because some of the hostages' families, for understandable reasons, are hesitant to be critical of the government because they need the government for the release of their loved ones. On the other hand, I think it was 3 weeks ago that the parents of some of the hostages said, as we say in Hebrew, must speak enough, and they have become very, very, very vocal against the government because I think they realize that they've been lied to by Netanyahu throughout, and I think they reached a conclusion that they, quote-unquote, have nothing to lose but to join the anti-government forces and to demonstrate with us. On the other hand, there are hostage families who won't join the government anti-government rallies because they feel that potentially endangers a deal or negotiate a deal for the release of their loved ones.
It's well documented, the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, a lot of suffering there. What are Israelis thinking about that?
It's an excellent question. It's a very, very complicated question. If you talk to Israelis center-left, you ask them two questions. One, are you aware of what's happening in what is happening in Gaza? And most people will say sure, because I mean they have family, sons, daughters, family members who are in the IDF. Two, you can see the pictures. And the next question is, does it bother you? And I don't. I didn't do a scientific poll, but call it a unscientific poll. Many people will tell you that what is uppermost in their mind is what happened on October 7th. In particular, the sexual violence against women, the rapes of the women, the killing of the children, the beheading of the children, the beheading of soldiers. And until that, being all the hostages are returned, everything else takes a back seat. And every time that we hear additional testimony, particularly the rape of the women, and it's unimaginable sexual violence against women, that takes, I think the correct expression would be, that is uppermost in people's mind, more than the harm done in Gaza to Gazans. And I also add to that, it's important to remember, when you look really carefully at the videos and the clips from October 7th, and when the hostages were brought back to Gaza, there was mass celebration. We need to remember that. Yes, it's Hamas who did October 7th. Yes, it's the 3,000 Hamas members who committed unimaginable war crimes. I mean, the crimes against the women is just, quote-unquote, off the charts. But it's also really important to look at the pictures and to see how, when hostages were brought, when they were brought back, how the local population celebrated. And that also very much is in the mind of many Israelis. Hmm.
By the way, should the International Criminal Court be issuing warrants for Hamas leaders for war crimes?
Well, the ICC, to the best of my recollection, doesn't issue against terrorist organizations, but it is, I think I'm right on that one. But it is an interesting question, what will happen to Hamas leaders? So, first of all, many Hamas members have been killed. The leadership sits in Qatar and in the tunnels. Talk about intelligence failure, because we put the tunnels forever. Sinwar, who's the head of Gaza, is still safely protected inside a tunnel. I assume one day he'll be killed. I assume there's been talk about granting him amnesty as a way to release the hostages. I don't see that. I don't think that will take place. And the ones who sit in Qatar are protected by Qatar, while Qatar is also engaged in negotiating the release of the hostages. Will the ICC or somebody else issue something against the guys from Hamas? I think the only ones who would try then would be Israel, if and when the Hamas leadership would be captured, detained, interrogated, prosecuted, unless they're killed in Israel, killed before that. I may be wrong, but I don't think that the international court would issue or take action against Hamas, particularly when the Israeli judicial system is more than equipped to prosecute them.
In the aftermath of the October 7th attacks, atrocities by Hamas in Israel, I heard some speculation that that Hamas fully expected a very robust, brutal response, and that was part of the calculation, that in the end, could further turn world opinion against Israel. I don't know if, I don't know if we get in the minds of the Hamas leaders here, but I wonder if
that's... You made a really important point. Hamas leadership and Sinwar, who's the head of Hamas, have zero interest whatsoever what happens to the Gazan population. I have no doubt that Sinwar, who spent time in jail in Israel, well understood that the response to October 7th would be what the response has been. Does that interest him? Not whatsoever. And that's why I think it's really important when we talk about the harm being done to Gaza, we need to point a long accusatory finger, j'accuse in French, at Hamas for the damage that's being done to Gaza. And there's been talk incessantly, but nothing more than talk. Will the local Gazan population turn against Hamas and say, as they say in Arabic, halas, enough? And there has been talk about that. There have been some, I wouldn't call it demonstrations, but there have been voices of discontent. But I don't think it's beyond voices of discontent, because I think it's clear that anybody in Gaza who protests against Hamas, it's clear what their end will be. I mean, we all understand that. But there is no doubt that Hamas leadership bears heavy responsibility for what is happening in Gaza. And that is a critical piece of the missing discussion, particularly when, with respect to college campuses. I'm pointing the finger at Israel. Some people, I get it, I understand it. But the question is, why is the finger not being pointed at Hamas for causing extraordinary harm and damage, not only today, but over the years, to the Gazan population? And that's something that absolutely deserves attention.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, I do want to talk a bit about what's happening in the United States. Protests on college campuses, including University of Utah, Utah State University, and others. I want to talk a bit about that. And near the end of the conversation, or when we come back, talk about how we get to peace. Right? That's how did we end this this specific instance, and then lasting peace. That's been quite elusive. We're talking with Amos Giora. He is a University of Utah law professor. He's a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen, splits his time between homes in Utah and Israel. We're talking about all the latest from Israel and Gaza. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with University of Utah law professor Amos Giora. He's a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen, splits his time between homes in Utah and Israel. Right now we're talking to him from Salt Lake City. He's talking to us from Salt Lake City. We're talking about the latest from Israel and Gaza, as well as the ongoing protests on college campuses in the U.S. We'll get into talking about that. Amos Gura served for 19 years in the Israeli Defense Forces as lieutenant colonel, held several senior command positions, including legal advisor to the Gaza Strip and commander of the IDF School of Military Law. And he's published several books, including The Crime of Complicity and Armies of Enablers. I want to start this segment, Amos Gura, with you did an op-ed, I think it was a few months ago, at The Hill, and that was, I think, republished in the Deseret News, taking to task college presidents. This is when some of those Ivy League presidents were in front of congressional committees. And it seemed like they couldn't get to condemnation of anti-Semitism among some of their students.
There are no words to describe the extraordinary incompetence of the now former presidents of Harvard and Penn. If I recall correctly, the president of MIT also testified, and she still holds her job. And in the congressional testimony of the somehow still president of Columbia 2 weeks ago is reflective of individuals who hold positions that it's utterly unclear to me how they receive those positions. And the president of Columbia, when she testified, I think it was 2 weeks ago, she's stating facts, and I don't know. I mean, it is remarkable to me to watch it. And then members of Congress are literally Googling what she's saying and calling her out on the polite word would be inaccuracies. The more accurate word is lies. So we'll go with inaccuracy, somewhere between the two. And it, to me, was absolutely stunning. And I'm second generation academic. My father was a professor at the University of Michigan, so I've been around the block in academia. At the end of the day, it's all about leadership. That is what this is all about. And the former presidents of Penn and Harvard, and I'm not sure what will be the fate of the present president of Columbia, is a case study in what happens when leadership fails. And you're right, you keep referencing, I served for 20 years in the military. I understand leadership. I totally understand that, and I also well understand the consequences of a lack of leadership, and that strikes me as what has happened at those institutions in particular, particularly Columbia, and particularly Columbia, I think would be accurate.
I want to get your take on the ongoing protests, because you started some Ivy League schools, others, now it's spread across the country, including protests at University of Utah and now recently Utah State University. Total right for people to protest, right? To express their opinions. What do you think?
I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. That was one of the most important places in terms of demonstrations against the war in Vietnam, where the SDS, the Students for Democratic Society, was ongoing. I, as a kid, this was part of my childhood, so I totally get it. And if people want to protest, demonstrate, I mean, that's fine. Free speech. I've explained this to my friends and family in Israel. Free speech, in many ways, is the underlying existential reality of America. You can like it, you can dislike it, but it is the First Amendment for a reason. The question for university presidents is, when does that free speech, however, in terms of time, place, manner, cross the line where it's no longer an expression of an opinion or speech, which is absolutely 100% essential. It is. The quintessential American identity, and I 100% understand it. However, when you prevent somebody from going to class, when somebody feels threatened, when you're not protecting this, when you can no longer guarantee the safety of individuals, that's when difficult decisions need to be made. And I think that here, for instance, at the University of Utah, I thought the administration's response here was allowing the demonstrations as well they should allow, but saying clearly, There are lines. The lines are when someone else's safety, security are potentially impinged. And those are limits, and I think that is absolutely correct. I'm a full-on supporter. You want to demonstrate? Demonstrate. You want to express your opinion? Express your opinion. However, other campuses strikes me as striking that proper balance. The problem is when you, A, don't articulate a balance, or then if you articulate a balance and you don't implement the balance, you then get caught in situations, whether it's Columbia a couple days ago or UCLA this morning. I literally can track UCLA. You can see there were protests, counter-protests. I'm clear where the police were for a couple of hours. Even the governor of California this morning has expressed concern about where was the, I don't know if it's the campus police or the LAPD. You see in other states, other campuses, different reactions. But again, I'm a huge proponent of the First Amendment. Absolutely 100%. People want to demonstrate, articulate their concerns, express their opinions, 100%. But again, time, place, matter. And when someone else's safety and security are at risk, that's when line drawing needs to occur and needs to be implemented.
The problem I'm going to bring up here is not a majority problem among the protesters, I don't think. And that is that some, I don't think it's a majority, some of the protesters, you hear chants, you hear views expressed that would be full-on anti-Semitic, right? Zionists need to die, that kind of thing. That would do it. What, are you concerned about that part of it?
The chant, for instance, the river to the sea. Anybody who understands the chant, river to the sea, is calling for the destruction of the state of Israel and as a result, the death slash murder of Israelis. By the way, not only Jews, because 50% of the Israeli population are Israeli Arabs. So when whoever is demonstrating is chanting the river to the sea, it is, for me, I don't know if I call it anti-Semitic, it's clearly calling for the destruction of the state of Israel and its inhabitants. If you destroy the state of Israel, you're calling for our death slash murder. And the effort by some to spin it into, well, it's just a chant, for me, that doesn't wash. Much like the student who I now understand is either suspended or expelled at Columbia, who he said at his own press conference, where he says, consider yourselves lucky that I'm not calling for the murder of Zionists. That person, I mean, that's problematic speech. I mean, I think you and I would agree that you want to express First Amendment freedom of speech? Absolutely. But not when you're calling for my death, much less my murder. And I think you also know, Tom, that when I wrote my book, The Crime of Complicity of the Bystander in the Holocaust, I was the recipient of death threats, emails, letters, and that's not protected speech.
By the way, how are these protests at college campuses in the U.S., how is this playing out in Israel? When you do people comment on this as you're talking to your neighbors in Israel?
I get people do comment on it. I think it's caught them by surprise, I think. There is some, I don't know if this will make sense to you, but there's a fair number of Israelis who are in academia in the United States. There's been talk that maybe if this trend continues, that this would perhaps result, always be an optimist, right, in what we call in English a reverse brain drain, that those Israeli academics who are here will go back to Israel, and also the possibility that Jewish students who feel uncomfortable on American college campus perhaps would move to Israel, when that's the optimistic view. But is it front page? It's up and down front, whether it's front page or not. Frankly, the most important issue in Israel is the hostages. And going into Rafiah, yes, no, and the student demonstrations are in the press, but take a back seat.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with a brief final segment with Amos Giora. He is University of Utah law professor, dual U.S.-Israeli citizen, splits his time between homes in Utah and Israel. And we're talking about all the latest from Israel and Gaza, as well as the ongoing protests on college campuses of the United States. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with University of Utah law professor Amos Giora. He's a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen, splits his time between homes in Utah and Israel. We're talking about the situation in Israel and Gaza, ongoing protests on college campuses in the United States as well. Professor Giora is author of several books, including The Crime of Complicity and Armies of Enablers. So, Ms. Giora, I want to read again from your op-ed piece in the Tribune in October of last year, soon after the Hamas attacks. You say, "Then negotiations, without using the word, will begin, resulting in Israeli withdrawal and seeming inevitable preparation for the next round. The larger, far more complex question is how we break this endless, tragic cycle of violence." I want to have you talk about that first part. How does this particular conflict end? What do you have hope that will end soon?
The only way this can end, at least temporarily end, because there's a two-part end, there's a temporary end and a final end, is the continued American pressure on Netanyahu not to go into Rafiah. And I don't know who's going to pressure Hamas, Qatar, Egypt, maybe, with respect to the hostages and leading to a ceasefire. That's how the first step ends, in a temporary end. The longer term thing, obviously extraordinarily complicated, is how do we begin the process of re-implementing carefully the Oslo peace process, yes, with all the challenges, difficulties, criticisms, and perhaps also failures, because the current cycle is not sustainable and needs to end. But again, I've been around the block, and I think you know that I also spent officially and unofficially probably 15 years negotiating implementation of the Oslo process and working back channel with Palestinians and Israelis to try to create a different model. The question is, who's going to rule Hamas? Who's going to rule Gaza? And there are different options. One is Hamas, which I don't think an Israeli government would agree to. I think probably also the Egyptians would prefer that Hamas not continue to rule Gaza. There's been talk about the Palestinian Authority coming back to Gaza. Don't forget the Palestinian Authority had ruled Gaza from 94 until, I think, 2004. It's true that the Gazan population, democratic elections, voted for Hamas over the Palestinian Authority. That is very much out there. There's also been talk about some kind of an international governance model. I'm a little bit more skeptical of that. From my perspective, as someone who has negotiated, the best model in a complicated environment would be the Palestinian Authority. How that will happen would require them to somehow convince the Gazans that they are not acting at the behest of Israel and or the United States, but are acting in the best interest of the local population. That challenge would be fully on the feet of, at the feet of the Palestinian Authority. The president of the Palestinian Authority, Mohammed Abbas, who, in parentheses, I spent a week with in Washington, he's now, I think, in his 30th year of a one-year term. He's not getting any younger. He's not particularly healthy. And one of the questions, obviously, much like in Israel, by the way, is who's going to be the next generation of leadership in the Palestinian Authority? That is an open question. That is a critical question, particularly if there is a sense that there's a need for Hamas to no longer govern Gaza.
I kind of hate to bring U.S. politics into this, but it's a reality. We're in an election year. I think timing on this will have an effect on the presidential election. This is all going to play out here in the U.S. against the backdrop of the election.
I think that there's an understanding, and I leave American politics to people like you, but I think there's understanding, if I understand correctly, that what is referred to as the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, which is very uncomfortable with President Biden's support of Israel, that may hurt him electorally. We're already in May. The election is in November. I'm not very good at math, which is why I went to law school, but I think that's 6 months. 6 months in politics is no more than 3.5 minutes, which means at some point, if indeed there is concern in the Biden camp about the potential cost for him of supporting Israel, I don't know if that means he will disengage or literally, bring the hammer down to Netanyahu. And that question again, in the complicated world of Israel, where Netanyahu is beholden to these two extreme right-wing members of his government who are beyond loathsome of the United States. They disdain the United States. They disdain Biden. It's actually extraordinary because we as Israelis can't make it through the day without American support. And notwithstanding that, the extreme right-wing in Israel, particularly these two members of the government, it's difficult for me to convey to you how disdainful they are of Biden and of the United States. And at some point, Biden needs to, I think, will either walk away from this or literally bring the hammer down on Netanyahu. I've been critical of Biden when he speaks to Netanyahu. You can't speak to Netanyahu in circular fashion. You can't speak to him between the lines. You have to speak to Netanyahu in clear, concise, simple sentences. And I was a little bit concerned that after every Biden-Netanyahu phone call, Tom Friedman would then write an op-ed in the New York Times explaining what Biden meant to say. The moment Friedman has to write an article in the New York Times explaining what Biden said to Netanyahu, that's a win-win for Biden, for Netanyahu, because it means that he was able to ignore what Biden said to him. That's a real problem when you link Israeli politics and American politics.
Well, we are reaching the end of our time. I know we have to let you go here. Amos Giora, thank you so much for checking in with us here. Perspective very valuable. Amos Giora is a University of Utah law professor, dual U.S.-Israeli citizen, splits his time between homes in Utah and Israel. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll go out, as we do on Thursdays, with Leo T. and Skywatcher.
It's one sky, many cultures, and many moons in our home solar system. Skywatcher Leo T. with you. Today, let's do a little solar system moon hopping and exploration of our most distant planet. When NASA's New Horizons mission flew past Pluto in 2015, it gave humanity our first up-close glimpse ever of Pluto and its five moons. Surprise! Also a giant pear or heart-shaped depression called Sputnik Planitia, comparable in size to the country of Mexico and dominating one of Pluto's hemispheres. How Sputnik Planitia formed remains unclear, but researchers have painted a picture of its origins. It's possible that a body about the size of Switzerland crashed into Pluto long ago and at a shallow angle. If true, this would also hint at Pluto's interior, what it may look like under its cryogenic surface. We've got a great picture on the Skywatcher website to look at from New Horizons. This close-up image of an equatorial region near the base of Pluto's bright heart-shaped feature shows a mountain range with peaks jutting as high as 11,000 feet above the surface. The mountains on Pluto likely formed more than 100 million years ago, mere youngsters in a 4.5 billion-year-old solar system. This suggests this region, which covers about 1% of Pluto's surface, may still be geologically alive today. Pluto has, once again, five moons in order from the distance from Pluto. They are Charon, Styx, Nix, Kerberos, and Hydra. Charon, the largest, is mutually tidally locked with Pluto and is massive enough that Pluto and Charon are sometimes considered a binary dwarf planet. New Horizons' view of Charon reveals a youthful and varied terrain. Scientists are surprised by the apparent lack of craters. A swath of cliffs and troughs stretching about 600 miles suggests widespread fracturing of Charon's crust, likely a result of internal geological processes. The image also shows a canyon deeper than the Grand Canyon and estimated 4 to 6 miles deep. And hopping over to Jupiter, Juno over there at Jupiter, that's one of our fine spacecraft out there, checks out Io. It's one of it's the most volcanic moon in the solar system and the most volcanic body that we know of. One of the four biggest moons of Jupiter, that Italian astronomer Galileo Galilei discovered it along with Ganymede, Callisto, Europa, and in 1610. This is when this all happened, the Galilean moons they are. We've learned a lot about these exotic bodies in the past 400 years thanks to ever-improving telescope views and close-up imagery snapped by voyaging spacecraft like the Voyagers and like NASA's Juno Jupiter orbiter. Indeed, Juno recently conducted two close flybys, and it is rich with volcanoes, and they caught a few of them in action. They also got some great close-ups and other data on the 127-mile-long lava lake called Loki Patera. There is an amazing detail showing these crazy islands embedded in the middle of a potentially magma lake rimmed with hot lava. The reflection of our instruments recorded on the lake, parts of Io's surface are smooth as glass, reminiscent of volcanically created obsidian on Earth. In December 2023, Juno came within about 930 miles of the surface. And since we're out here, let's take the little Skywatcher spaceship over to Saturn with its rings, which are fun to find in your small telescope, and its moons. NASA is going to deploy another planetary space copter after having success with Mars on Perseverance. NASA's Dragonfly mission to Saturn's largest moon, Titan, is on track to launch in July 2028, the space agency confirmed. This highly anticipated decision greenlights the mission team to proceed to final mission design and testing in preparation for the revised launch date. That car-sized Dragonfly, which is being built by John Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel, Maryland, will reach Titan in 2034. Also orbiting Saturn, Saturn's ocean moon, Enceladus, may be able to support life. A research team is working out how to detect extraterrestrial cells there. A planetary scientist and astrobiologist who studies ice grains from Enceladus is interested in whether there is life on this or other icy moons and wants to understand how scientists can detect it. On Skywatcher Leo T, it's one sky, many cultures, and this is a story from the Navajo. Traditionally and historically, Navajo refer to themselves as the Diné, meaning the people. Sacred stories passed down from generation to generation tell of earthly and cosmological origins and of relationships with continuous historical evolution through four worlds, ultimately leading to an emergence that brought the Navajo to their present location. Navajo legends hold that the Thunderbird constellation emerges in the sky, carries all the clouds in his tail and rain under his wings. Thus, when the Thunderbird constellation is shining brightly in the sky, spring has arrived, so the Thunderbird has arrived up there. Credit the Native American mythology cylinder. So intriguing to be alive, look up, look around, and get a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.
This is Wild About Utah.
My formal introduction to gray-tailed grackles was on a birding trip to Box Elder County. We stopped at the Walmart parking lot in Brigham City, where Dick Hearn took a cup of cat food and tossed it out in front of our parked car. Then we watched the grackles fly in. We joked at the time that grackles seemed to spontaneously show up at new stores. It's almost as if they hitchhike on semis. The Brigham City grackles had long V-shaped tails. Dick explained that three grackle species are native in the U.S. Florida's boat-tailed grackles are found along the east and Gulf coasts, and common grackles are found mostly east of the Rockies. Mexican or great-tailed grackles have become the most common in developed areas of the West, although according to eBird and UtahBirds.org, both common and great-tailed varieties frequent Utah. Grackle species are also distinguished by their size and color. Between a robin and a crow in size, they're about the same length as an American crow, but not as heavy. Common grackles have more varied colors and long tails. Boat-tailed grackles have dark eyes, whereas great-tailed males are iridescent black with piercing yellow eyes. Female great-tails are dark brown above and paler below, with a buff-colored throat and a stripe above the eye. Juveniles have coloring similar to females, with a dark eye. Omnivorous, grackles forage in fields, feedlots, golf courses, cemeteries, parks, neighborhoods, and parking lots. Trees and reeds near water provide roosting and breeding sites where larger males claim their flock's territory with song. Great tails have an unusually large repertoire of vocalizations that are used year-round. Flamboyant males perform a wider variety, while females engage mostly in chattering sounds. Chut from females and clack from males warn of humans or other predators. Even though most female calls are low-key, there are reports of females singing their own territorial song. Because they're loud and large numbers of birds can leave great deposits of droppings, grackles are often considered pests. This designation is especially true in Texas and other southern states where flocks of 100,000 or more roam parking lots. And they're smart. Icterids, the New World blackbirds, including bobolinks, meadowlarks, ravens, crows, and grackles, are set apart from many birds by their intelligence. Grackles adapt their behavior with experience and habitat. The Audubon website notes, they're clever foragers. Great-tailed grackles can solve Aesop's fable tests, dropping stones into a container of water in order to sufficiently raise the level to pluck out a prize. Sometimes I enjoy stepping back and observing parking lot ecology. I look for grackles. Then I marvel at how our world would look and smell without birds to clean up after us. Above all, I enjoy hearing male and female great-tailed grackles singing in the trees or watching them forage between cars. Take five and give it a try. I'm Lyle Bingham, and I'm Wild About Utah.